Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, and it's All Things Political, which you always hear Monday at 9. We have so much to talk about today. We'll start with what's been going on in Iran, and today we get some rather surprising news from the country's spiritual leader, Khamenei, that there has been an investigation ordered into claims of vote rigging. There's been a major opposition rally held in defiance of a ban. Fresh street violence breaking out in Tehran as demonstrators have come under attack from supporters of the incumbent president, Ahmadinejad. We'll be looking at that situation and how the world has responded to this. We also have a lot of news going on here in the United States. The president in Chicago today speaking before the AMA on health care reform. We'll talk about that. Since we last spoke, a horrible incident at the American Holocaust Museum, and we'll be talking about whether or not there has been some kind of egging on of this kind of right-wing extremism, particularly by media, some forms of the media, and we will talk about that. And, well, there's a lot to talk about this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and we have two guests with us. We start with Jamie Kumarasamy. Jamie is a reporter for the BBC and has done reporting all over the world. His degree is in modern languages, Russian and French, from Trinity Hall, Cambridge. He started in Moscow in 1991, just after the August coup. He covered the events surrounding the collapse of the Soviet Union. He covered events such as the first war in Chechnya and President Yeltsin's dramatic reelection campaign in 96. London-based reporter then on the Today program, then to Paris as a BBC correspondent. And he has been here in the United States reporting on everything from presidential and congressional politics to space shuttle launches and Oscar ceremonies. We'll have another guest the second half hour who's an international relations political scientist. Jamie, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Yeah. Nice to be back.
Nice to have you here. Let's talk about what's happened in Iran, ever-changing situation. Now, all of a sudden, we're getting some official doubt cast over Ahmadinejad's reelection victory. Were you surprised today by the country's supreme commander ordering an investigation into this election?
I think it was a surprise. It is, as we say, a rather fluid situation over there. My colleagues, quite a few colleagues over in Tehran, they've had all sorts of issues with phone lines being jammed, brief arrests, all kinds of very complicated and complex things. But yes, I think this was a surprise, and it's given clearly the supporters of the opposition candidate, Mousavi, some glimmer of hope. But at the moment, things simply aren't clear, and I think a lot of people are waiting to hear something from something clearer from the Obama administration. President Obama, as you say, giving his big speech on health reform. But he, I think as the hours will go on, he'll be under some pressure to make some kind of statement, whether it's him or whether it's the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, we don't know yet. But I think a lot of countries are looking to the United States to give some kind of lead. But it's difficult in this situation, which, as we've said, is very fluid.
Yeah. Do you think there's enough evidence right now that this presidential election was stolen?
Hard to say from here, but certainly talking to people in the country, you know, the big doubt was over the swiftness with which we had that result and the big result, the big victory for President Ahmadinejad, given that so many of these ballots were paper ballots. That was where the big question marks came. There's some conflicting evidence. I noticed in the Washington Post today an op-ed by a couple of gentlemen who have done some very detailed polling in Iran, and they're saying, well, actually, if you looked at the rural areas, even some of the areas which were said to be strongholds for Mousavi, actually, some of the polling data suggested that this is not a surprising result, that actually Ahmadinejad might well have done as well as this. But their voices have been counterbalanced by quite a lot of questioning ones. So I think, you know, there's no clear sense at the moment. I think the immediate concern is what will happen on the streets and whether that will spiral out of control.
Right. And then it's trouble, right? Nobody wants an Iran that's in great turmoil.
No, they don't. I mean, some will say that, you know, actually, from some people's point of view, having Ahmadinejad in there in a position where his legitimacy is perhaps questioned, makes him weaker, and actually that strengthens the hand of those who are trying to put pressure on him to give up his nuclear ambitions. But no, I think the broad point is no one wants turmoil. Iran is clearly an absolute key power in the region, and you know, with the nuclear question up in the air, nobody wants to see the potential for civil unrest.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the president. What should the president be addressing right now, in addition to health care in Chicago in his speech? What should he be saying about Iran?
Well, you know, luckily I'm not the president, so I don't have to take a clear line on what is a very unclear situation. I mean, we had over the weekend, we had statements from his press secretary saying, you know, it's, you know, we're glad there's been a vigorous election campaign. I think until there is clear evidence of vote rigging, empirical evidence, it's very difficult for him to come out, especially at a key moment. You know, obviously we've had the speech over the weekend from Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel as well, again talking about Iran and Israel's concerns about Iran's nuclear program. So anything that seemed to be tipping the balance at this point will be tricky. But as I say, I think there will be pressure for some kind of statement in the next few hours.
Do you feel at all a wind of change in the Middle East, or are we making too much of that?
Well, I think, you know, winds have changed. Do they start as mere puffs of air, or they, you know, are they immediately huge, raging you know, storms? It's hard to tell. But clearly, what's happened in Iran is a pretty interesting and potentially a key moment. I mean, if you look, for example, what's happened with all the social media sites, how the authorities have tried to stop the bad news, the news of the protests getting out, but it's simply not been possible to block everything. You know, it's a very young democracy. I think, you know, large parts of Iran are under the age of 32, so about 50%, I think. It's a country where they've embraced the outside world, just as they've had a leader who seems to be turning inwards and being far more hostile. So I think that's been one very interesting aspect of this. It's shown that there is something organic about this, whether it's, you know, whether you call it pure democracy or you call it something else, that has been very, very difficult, if impossible, for the leadership of a country to deal with.
Mm-hmm. The president in Chicago talking about health care. We've had an interesting conversation in the past about the differences in health care between your country and this country. Do you think that he's gaining some kind of support? Has he been specific enough about what kind of reform he wants to have happen in this country?
I think the specifics start now. I mean, he's been specific about numbers. He's been specific. He's had the big photo op at the White House with a whole, you know, raft of stakeholders, if you like, in these reforms, people from the insurance industry, from the pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, that's important, but it's got to the point now where people want to see numbers, and they are going to see a much more vigorous debate where that $2 trillion that will be needed is going to come from, who will be taxed and where. And, you know, I think probably the big answer is no, he hasn't, but probably because it wouldn't have been wise to until now. He knows that this is the issue that has defeated Democratic presidents again and again, onwards from the Second World War, and he knows that he will be judged to some extent, to a large extent, on this. He's trying to avoid the mistakes, clearly, of the Clinton administration, to bring everyone on board, to make it as public as possible. But there is still a visceral skepticism amongst large numbers of Americans for anything that resembles a public funded health service. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's something that's taken for granted in my country and in large parts of Europe, but it is a cultural thing, and that's very, very hard to change.
Do you think that he's going to encounter quite a bit of skepticism from the doctors in the audience today, or some people interested in a major change?
I would suspect that those who've been invited are generally going to be keen to hear what he says. I don't suspect many people coming to listen to him will be out-and-out opponents, but I think there will be. I think, you know, there is a healthy debate within the medical community about what's the best way forward, so I'm sure there will be some questions raised. Now, it's not clear from what we've heard from the White House whether there will be a question-and-answer session or not, but I think this will be a point, you know, the start of this phase of the debate and the start of what's likely to be a very intense political summer over this health reform issue.
Mm-hmm. And a major issue it is. He has said, and many others have said, that it's so tied into the whole American economy that you can't have real economic reform unless you have health care reform in the country.
That's right. And it's been interesting from day one of his presidency, in fact, from before he assumed office during that interim period. He was very, and he has been very, very careful at every stage to put healthcare at the center of everything, even when the talk was purely of the economic stimulus package or of other not immediately related aspects. The president has been, you know, if you look back on those speeches, he has said, look, it all comes down to health reform, and health reform, you cannot put that off. And, you know, a healthy nation will be a more productive nation. This is something that we have to get right for all classes, all aspects of society. In order to be more productive, in order to get us through this recession. So, you know, he has, and if you like, this is the start of a new phase, but healthcare has never been anything but central to his rhetoric from the beginning of his presidency.
Mm-hmm. We've had, as you well know, some horrendous incidents of domestic terrorism, the most recent last week at the Holocaust Museum in Washington. People have been talking a lot on cable television, and Frank Rich had an interesting column in yesterday's Times about the tiny subset of domestic terrorists and whether or not they're egged on by political or media demagogues. A couple questions here. Do you think they are? And do you have anything similar in England to the kinds of Rush Limbaugh figures that we have in America?
Well, answer to your second question. No, nothing of, I suppose we're much smaller. We, you know, but also there's no one of that stature, I would say. There's no one who has that amount of influence, certainly for the length of time that Rush Limbaugh has had his influence on large parts of you know, the conservative voters and conservative thought. No, it's simply not the case. And, you know, interesting, there was an incident a few weeks ago, which you may or may not have recall, when one of the other conservative talk show hosts, Michael Savage, was actually banned from Great Britain by the Home Secretary. It's something that's seen as a bit of an anathema in Britain, actually. As far as the relationship between that and these incidents, you know, it's very hard to you know, these individuals who carry out these incidents, the man at the Holocaust Museum, there's been others, the attack in Arkansas, of course, on some soldiers. There was, of course, the killing of the doctor who carried out abortions. That all these people that carried out are clearly mentally disturbed individuals. And it's, it's difficult. I find it hard to try and, I find myself stepping back from drawing any immediate links from what they may or may not have heard on the radio or on other programs. But I suppose if the numbers of incidents spiral, and if the atmosphere on the airwaves is seen in some way to be encouraging it, you know, it's difficult not to start drawing links. But I think we have to be very careful in attributing the actions of disturbed individuals to what they hear on the airwaves or see on the television.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Jamie in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do that. And that is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Jamie is Washington correspondent for the BBC and has done reporting all over the world, including a long stretch in Russia. And we later will speak with a professor of political science and international studies at Louisiana State University. Here's our number again, 800-486-8655. We'll be with you in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Alan from Madison. Hi, Alan.
Hi. My question concerns the Obama policy in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it's a two-part question, and if possible, I'd like an answer to both parts. If Obama wants to stop the drone flights, which have resulted in innocent people, including children, being killed in Afghanistan and Pakistan, could he do it? And the second part is, if he doesn't stop the drone flights and innocent people continue to be killed periodically, should we hold him personally responsible for those deaths? And that's my question.
Okay, thank you. Jamie, go ahead.
Yes. Well, I suppose the answer to the first question is yes, he can. He's a commander-in-chief. At any point, he can, if he decides that any particular given policies, he can get on the phone to his military chief. They'll decide, they'll advise him on the military wisdom or otherwise of stopping it. But technically, yes, he can. As far as the responsibility, now this is clearly something that the U.S. military is very worried about, this question of civilian casualties. They know, and we've seen in Iraq, but also in Afghanistan, and clearly in Pakistan as well, the damage to not just the military effort, but the diplomatic efforts that are part of it, that the deaths of civilians do. And the new commander, Stanley McChrystal, in interviews over the last week or so, including one with the BBC, was adamant that there will be an inquiry, that there will be into the deaths of civilians as part of any military action that the American military has carried out. But unfortunately, it has been something that's happened. As for responsibility, and the responsibility of any president, I suppose, is individual wartime incidents. That was something that was debated very healthily under President Bush during a number of incidents in Iraq, and I suspect it's not one that's ever really had a final outcome. But yes, I think most people would ultimately hold the person who's decided to take a particular course of action responsible. With President Obama, of course, he is inheriting a war, he's inheriting a strategy, and he could at any moment decide to change it, but that complicates it somewhat. But he knows that, yes, ultimately the buck stops with him.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. A brief comment, although we could do a show on this, about these incredible expense claims filed by lawmakers in England, subsequent problems for Gordon Brown for other reasons as well. But can you comment on that? Whatever happened with that?
Is that, just a couple of weeks after the story was very extensively covered, the Labour Party, the party in power, had an absolutely atrocious showing in both the local elections and in the European elections. In particular, in the European elections, it came third behind the Conservative opposition,
oh my,
but also a party called the UK Independence Party, which is advocating pulling Britain out of the European Union. He has lost a whole raft of government ministers. But what's happened in the short term is he has survived. It's a fairly complex political story in Britain, but Gordon Brown has survived mainly because there's nobody else out there to take over that the party has backed. He is limping on. He could, as you know, under the British system, he can call an election whenever he wants. So there's a potential for it to be called in October, but he could survive until next June. That's the longest he could possibly stay in power. But he is a very weakened leader, and the Labour Party is in a very, very weak position.
Let's go next to Wayne from Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Wayne.
Yeah, good morning. Good to talk to you guys this Monday. I just need something clarified, and I think maybe I didn't hear you particularly correct, Kathleen, and I want to give you the benefit of the doubt. But are we really trying to lump all conservative talk show hosts and link them to this nut that shot the guard at the Holocaust Center? I know for a fact that Rush Limbaugh is a big-time, for example, Israeli supporter. I'm trying to understand the logic, and then maybe both of you can explain it to me.
I guess the question is whether or not people like Limbaugh, he's not probably as sensational. He's pretty sensational, but not as sensational as some of the other people who are, kind of riling people up. It's hard to listen to those shows without feeling that he wants Obama to fail. He's sort of on this diatribe against how horrible things are. But you've got other people who have made there was a fill-in guy for Rush Limbaugh who was talking about any soldier who found himself with only two bullets in an elevator with Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, and Osama bin Laden would use both shots to assassinate Pelosi and then strangle Reid and bin Laden. I mean, it's
unforgivable.
Yeah, that kind of stuff just shouldn't be on the airwaves, I think.
Exactly.
So
that's unforgivable.
Yeah, and I'd agree with you. I do think, I don't think you can draw a, you know, this guy, the guy that killed the guard at the Holocaust Museum, he had previous convictions. He had tried to, you know, for kidnapping members of the Federal Reserve. I mean, this guy was out there. Was, you know, I really don't think you can draw any link from the words of someone like Rush Limbaugh to someone like him. I do think we have to be very, very careful. You know, there is a healthy debate on the American airwaves. You know, like him or not like him, Rush Limbaugh is part of American democracy. There are others out there on the other political wings having their say as well. You know, I don't think you can draw a line between him and between some nutcase who goes out and murders, you know, an anti-Semite like that, who goes out and murders on the basis of these long-held, very dark beliefs.
Yeah.
Thank you both. Go Brewers, Kathleen.
I'm with you, Wayne.
God bless.
All right, bye-bye. Thanks. Thanks very much for the call. We have time for probably one more call for Jamie, and then we're just going to change guests and bid adieu to Jamie. Mike from Appleton, hi.
Yeah, good morning. A question for your guest there, and based upon his rather vast knowledge of world events, do what I think in large part to our inaction. Eventually, Iran is going to have a nuclear weapon and the capability to deliver it. What is your vision of what's going to happen in the Middle East when that event comes to pass?
Wow, I mean that will clearly be a game changer. I guess should that day happen, it rather depends who's in control, but I very much doubt that Israel will allow that to get anywhere close to happening without taking some kind of preemptive action, because they clearly, from Israel's point of view, this is an absolute threat to their existence. I can't possibly guess at what that would be or how the United States would react to that, but all I could tell you is it will be a situation that everybody would hope to avoid. If I was in a position to tell you more than that, I would. But it is a frightening proposition, I think, for the Middle East, and that's why everyone is trying. But as you hint, without much success, frankly, until now, to try and stop Iran's nuclear ambitions going forward, so it has a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Jamie, are you going back to England, aren't you?
I'm going back to England in a few weeks' time. I've had 4.5 years here in the States. I've had a wonderful, wonderful time. A fascinating election to cover.
Yes.
All kinds of other things. But it's very sad to go. But we move on. I'll be going back to Europe. Lots of things to report there.
Right. Well, it's good to get home, too.
It is.
Yeah. Thank you ever so much for being with us. We'll talk to you. I mean, it's a small world. We'll talk to you in England, too.
I hope so, too.
Thank you. Thanks, Jamie.
All the best.
Yeah, to you as well. Jamie Kumarasamy, he is the Washington correspondent for the BBC. As I said, he has traveled all over the world reporting for the BBC, and his assignment in Washington is now up, and he goes back to England, but we'll talk to him again because we can talk to him from England. That's the wonder of modern telephones. All right, we're going to continue. It's all things political. We just have a new guest joining us the next half hour with a special emphasis on, obviously, what's been going on in Iran. Our guest this half hour is joining us from Louisiana, where he has a joint appointment at Louisiana State University's International Studies Program, also a visiting fellow at St. Anthony's College, Oxford University, visiting professor at Tehran University. He has served frequently as a consultant to the U.S. Department of State and other organizations, and he will be here to talk about what's been going on internationally. Our guest is Professor Mark Gazarovsky, and our phone number remaining the same, 800-486-8655. Professor Gazarovsky, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
All right, let's go to Iran. You have taught there? Are you teaching there now as well, have you, recently?
No, I taught there at several occasions in the 1990s.
Uh-huh. How do you respond to what in the world, what has happened there in the last week? It's just a gripping story, but it's hard to figure out what the truth is. Can you start with the amount of opposition that we seem to be seeing from people at universities, young people? It's quite overwhelming to see these huge demonstrations.
Yes. Well, there was quite a mobilization of people in the last few weeks before the election last Friday, in the lead up to the election, increasing numbers of people came out in the streets and did various things to indicate their support for the main opposition candidate, Mir Hossein Mousavi, opposition to Ahmadinejad. Late Friday night, they announced that Ahmadinejad had won an overwhelming victory. And so at that point, all these many supporters of Mousavi then began to protest against what they considered to be the rigging of the election. And so Saturday and Sunday, there was extensive rioting throughout Tehran and other cities. It's impossible to know the numbers, but it certainly seems very large numbers of people were out in the street. And I think they were much more than just students and young people. Clips that I saw on YouTube indicated a lot of middle-aged people, a lot of women, all kinds of people out in the streets. Whether that's continuing today remains to be seen. It's currently, I guess, about 6 p.m. or so in Tehran. I saw a report from Reuters just a little while ago saying that a rally that initially Mousavi's supporters had called for today and that was declared illegal by the government has drawn tens of thousands of people. So it seems that maybe this big mobilization of opposition to Ahmadinejad is continuing today, but it's a little hard to tell.
Mm-hmm. When you follow the election results, do you think that there's any doubt at all that this was not an honest and fair election, or may it indeed have been, and we were just surprised by the results?
No, I don't think there's any doubt at all that this was rigged. There's just no way that two-thirds of the population would have voted for Ahmadinejad. You know, in the run-up to the election, in the last several weeks, there was this huge outpouring of support for Mousavi, clearly much larger numbers of people, maybe 10 times as many people were coming out in the street for Mousavi as for Ahmadinejad. And it's clear that Ahmadinejad's support has been falling sharply over the 4 years he's been president. So I just don't believe this at all. And the results were announced very prematurely. Mousavi's stronghold in the northwestern part of the country, where he should have done especially well because he's an Azeri Turk, which are the kinds of people who live in that part of the country, even there, according to the official results, Ahmadinejad won. That's just incredible. It's just not believable. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe for a minute that that Ahmadinejad legitimately won.
Mm-hmm. So how will the truth be found?
I don't think the truth really will be found in the sense that, they'll release the true numbers. They may not even have the true numbers. There are a lot of ways elections can be rigged. And if indeed, they literally stuff ballot boxes, put in lots of falsified ballots, well, then there's no way at this point to determine what the real numbers were. I mean, the only way you really could would be to rerun the election, which, of course, a lot of people are calling for. But even then, it would be different from the election that was held on Friday, probably a lot more anti-Ahmadinejad protest votes. So the truth isn't really going to come out of how the election went, but I don't think anybody really has any doubt that this was a falsified election.
And tell me more about Mousavi. Why the support for him? What's the attraction?
Well, first of all, his background. He's an intellectual and an artist. He was trained as an architect. He became prime minister back in, I believe it was 1981, and was prime minister of Iran until 1989. So he has an established track record from that period. He's widely regarded as having been a very competent leader at that time, very competent prime minister, and especially as having steered Iran successfully through the difficulties of the war with Iraq and having run the economy about as well as could be expected. So he has a good reputation as a technocrat and a very intelligent person. In 1989, when he stepped down as prime minister, and in fact that position was eliminated, he then went off and focused on being an artist and painting. So for 20 years, he was largely out of the public eye. He did hold a few rather minor positions in that period, but nothing of any consequence. But his views certainly evolved in the direction that the Iranian reformists' views evolved. He was always very close to President Khatami, the reformist prime minister, reformist president who served from 1997 to 2005. He always reflected the same kinds of ideas that Khatami had. Khatami, in this past several months, has campaigned very strongly in his favor. So it seems quite clear that Mousavi has, you know, very reformist, pro-democracy, pro-freedom ideas, although wanting to do that within the context of maintaining an Islamic regime. He's not a very charismatic figure. He's pretty dull. So he did not really himself stir up any kind of a big popular movement in the weeks leading up to the election. But nonetheless, clearly lots and lots of Iranians became very excited about the possibility of him becoming president. They saw this as a move back to the Khatami years of 1997 through 2005, and clearly that was very popular among large numbers of people. That being said, though, it's important to keep in mind that Iran is a very deeply divided population. We can say, you know, sort of modern sector Iranians versus traditional sector Iranians, although that oversimplifies things. But there are a lot of Iranians who want more freedom in these kinds of things. On the other hand, there are a lot of very traditional Iranians who want to, you know, push Islam very strongly. They have a very conservative interpretation of Islam. So it's a deeply divided society, and this is what we're seeing. We're seeing, you know, one of those branches of society fighting against the other for control over the presidency. It's not really that different from the U.S., where, you know, the difference between Democrats and Republicans, or the left and the right, is very, very strong in the U.S.
I was about to ask you, do we have sort of a red state, blue state thing going on here?
Very much, yeah.
Huh, interesting. And the dissatisfaction, well, let's talk about the support for Ahmadinejad. We've read that it's working class people, they feel that he's done great things for them. Who supports him?
Well, I would say that support for Ahmadinejad comes from two main sorts of people. First of all, real hardline ideologues who want to go back to the radical Islamic regime of the 1980s when Iran was carrying out a cultural Islamization program, for example, forcing women to cover themselves, redoing school curricula to reflect an Islamic slant, trying to export its revolution, doing all these kinds of things, a radical Islamic regime as Iran had back then 25 years ago. So there are, first of all, these ideologues who support him. And then secondly, in his nearly 4 years as president, he has done a great deal of traditional patronage type of things, you know, handing out basically Iran's oil money to common people, especially in rural areas, basically to buy their political support, you know, providing jobs, you know, repaving roads, these kinds of things in traditional patronage way. So he's built up a lot of he built up a fair amount of support in that way. Now, that being said, I think most Iranians are very unhappy with the poor economic performance under Ahmadinejad. Inflation shot up from about 12% to a high of 30% under him. Unemployment seems to have been going up. There is not any evidence that he cracked down on corruption as he promised to do 4 years ago, and indeed he's appointed some very wealthy, presumably corrupt people to key positions. He's also very much aggravated relations with the West, you know, by criticizing Israel, denying the Holocaust,
sure,
pursuing the nuclear program, these kinds of things. And a lot of Iranians are very alarmed by that. I think probably the large majority. My guess is that no more than, say, 30% or so really support him for one of the two reasons that I just gave. And most of the remainder are pretty much against him.
Mm-hmm. It is pretty embarrassing, I'm sure, for a number of Iranians to have as your leader somebody who is so ignorant that he would say again and again there was no Holocaust, isn't it?
Yes, a lot of Iranians are very disgusted by that. But keep in mind, this is all seen in a very different way from Iran's point of view. You know, the Holocaust was part of European history, Western history, not Iranian or Middle Eastern history. So, you know, Iranians know much less about it than we do in the West. And Iranians are generally a lot less educated, a lot less worldly and cosmopolitan than we are. So many Iranians, particularly poor Iranians who are not well educated, have a very different view of the Holocaust than we do. And, you know, that being said, even in the United States, if you go out to the more backward parts of the U.S., there are a lot of people who don't really know what the Holocaust was. If you ask them what that word means, they don't really know and have only a vague idea that, you know, 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazis in World War II. So it's not just Iranians. But, you know, he very much plays on the support of those kind of poorly educated, predominantly rural Iranians. And another thing is that any kind of statement about Israel and about Jews is seen very much in the Arab-Israeli context. And Iranians, although they're not Arabs, they're Persians, they very much sympathize with the Palestinians, and they're very much against Israel. So anything that is, you know, against Israel, against Jews, a lot of Iranians will support in a knee-jerk way without even thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls now for Mark. Our guest this half hour of the program is Professor Mark Gazarovsky. He is at Louisiana State University Political Science International Studies Program and has also been a visiting professor at Tehran University. We're talking because it was a momentous election, and what's going on there is important to peace in the rest of the world. I guess another question here is, as we suggested the first half hour, it's not in anybody's interest to have a tumultuous Iran. So what can help bring some semblance of order to the country? What role the United States and other countries in that? Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and this is the iIdeas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday, Lori Schneider will be with us, a mountain climber, teacher of special ed and elementary education. And she, you're probably aware of her story, she was diagnosed with MS in 1999, and she recently climbed Mount Everest. She has climbed the tallest peaks of many continents and has quite an inspirational story to tell. She'll be with us hour number two. All right, let's go to phone calls now for Mark and to Nancy from West Bend. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, good morning. I've read and heard that the gentleman who's running to be elected's wife is very influential and highly educated. I wonder if you could say a little bit about the role women played in this election, and have they actually been allowed to vote, or are they disenfranchised?
Yes, that's a very interesting and important issue. First of all, Iranian women can vote and have been able to vote since 1963. And in the last decade or so, Iranian women have become an increasingly important constituency. There have been a number of very, very profound changes in the status of Iranian women that have made them increasingly independent and increasingly politically active, like much higher levels of education. For example, women outnumber men by a ratio of almost 2-1 in Iran's universities. Women's fertility rate, the number of children born per woman, has fallen from 7 about 15 years ago to 2 today. So there have been huge changes in women's conditions in Iran. And the result of those various changes is that women have become more and more politically active. There has been a very strong women's movement over the past decade that has regular demonstrations and things of that sort, and women have become a very important political constituency. And we've seen now in these last two presidential elections candidates in various ways, you know, very openly appealing for women's votes. In this election, the wife of the main challenger, Mir Hossein Mousavi, his wife's name is Zahra Ranavard. She's a very prominent woman in her own right. She she was a professor and then chancellor of a major university in Iran. She's also an artist. She's very well known. She's probably one of the 10 or 20 most prominent women in Iran. She very extensively campaigned on her husband's behalf. This was very much a sort of a Hillary Clinton kind of an approach. And this seems to have resonated very much with Iranian women at the rallies before the election last Friday. Lots and lots of women showed up. Clearly, Mousavi was getting a lot of support from Iranian women. And that's part of the disappointment here, is that that has been really suppressed.
That seems to me all the more reason why the election should have gone the other way. I was so surprised when I heard those results. And I didn't believe it any more than the rest of us, but I'm afraid that the man who has the prime minister or whatever his title is that has the right to just make this decision will not make it in the way we would like to see it.
Yeah. Well, of course, we don't want to impose our own views as Americans on Iran, but many Iranian women feel extremely disappointed that Ahmadinejad apparently is the winner and that that Mousavi will not become the next president.
And what about the Ayatollah Khamenei? What role does he play in moving all of this forward?
Well, his position, which is usually called in English supreme leader, is an extremely powerful position in Iran's political system. It's roughly like the position of a king, frankly, with essentially all power, you know, ultimately concentrated in his hands. Under the Constitution, he basically has the ability to do whatever he wants. And he has become increasingly hardline in the last 20 years or so since he's been in this position. He has been sort of quietly supporting Ahmadinejad in these past 4 years. And he very clearly supported this stealing of the vote that occurred. He made a statement, I believe it was on Saturday, strongly endorsing these falsified election results. So many people are calling this a coup d'etat by Ahmadinejad and Khamenei working together to basically squash the electoral results.
Mm-hmm. And yet today we have word that he has called for an inquiry into vote rigging claims.
Yeah, I think that will be just a charade, frankly. I think he said that he wants the inquiry completed within 10 days. Well, 10 days is a long time. If that plays out for 10 days, that'll be 10 days within which the pro-Mousavi movement will sort of lose its steam, and that's what he's hoping for.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what we would see is 10 days from now, they would announce that the election was valid, and, you know, by then a lot of people would have sort of fallen into this sullen, passive state of mind, and the crisis would have passed.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's doing here.
Let's go to Rick from La Crosse next. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm very impatient with this constant drumbeat of demonization of Iran in the press, in the U.S. press. And I think that, gosh, we forget, they released the sailors that they captured on the high seas. They released Sabaris. Now, you know, they're calling for an investigation and, you know, what if we had that in 2000? And I don't know why everybody's all worked up over Iran having a nuclear when Pakistan, which has many more radicals, already has nuclear weapons, and but, you know, they go unmolested. I guess that does send a powerful message that those who have nukes aren't molested.
Well, I wouldn't portray it in black and white terms, as the media does, certainly. Iran is a mixture of good and bad, I would say. You know, some things that they do that are, you know, very dangerous to the U.S. or to world stability, other things not so bad. And I agree that the media portrays Iran generally in a pretty negative way and fairly inaccurate way. But that being said, Iran does pose a lot of dangers. You know, we certainly don't want to see another country with nuclear weapons in its hands, particularly a country led by a guy like Ahmadinejad, who is really pretty off the wall in many ways. Iran has been supporting Islamist guerrillas of various kinds in Iraq who have killed hundreds of American troops there. Not at all condoning what the U.S. is doing in Iraq. I've been opposed to it from the beginning, but there are hundreds of Americans who have been killed by Iranian-backed people there. And there have been various other incidents, you know, over the past 30 years. So while Iran isn't the boogeyman that is portrayed in some circles, it's also, you know, far from being saintly. It's somewhere in the middle, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. We go next to Adam from Madison. Hi, Adam.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having this very fine program. And before I ask my sort of pointed couple of questions, I want to say that the speaker is highly qualified and is doing a very good job. Some of this is difference of opinion over nuances and different sets of facts. So first of all, I'd like to correct our speaker on the low education, low whatever of the Iranians. If you go up on the CIA World Book website and do comparisons, for example, Pakistan has about 27% literacy rate, Afghanistan about a 17%. And Iran, actually, I believe, unless my memory fails me, over 70% of the population is literate, and this is one of the key measures of you know, sort of education around the world. You know, in terms of a population, it's on the whole, even at the lowest level, has a some degree of education. Next point I'd like to make is that I agree with the sort of demonization. I'm a historian. I'm writing a book about films right now, and the only two countries in the Middle East that had any kind of critical film industry criticizing things in the society are Israel and Iran. Iran has actually, even during the last 4 years, has allowed filmmakers to make very biting, scathing films about women, you know, their situation, and about ethnic minorities. So there is a black and white portrayal here. And finally, you've said nothing about the class question. And I'm a social historian, and I find it amazing that you haven't pointed out that the socioeconomic class that backed the reformists are the ones who benefited the most from the modern technology in the cities, the educated professionals and the like. One of the things that's given the current president his base is he poured a huge amount of money, not just in payoffs, but in genuine rural development for poor people in the villages, and a certain amount of working class study stuff in the cities. I certainly wouldn't want to be under his administration. I condemn theocracy, but to miss the populist element in the entire Iranian revolution of the last 30 years is to just completely misread then why there's going to be such a broad struggle. Until the so-called reformers take on the class issues and the huge income differences in Iran, I don't think they'll ever have a chance of having a healthy majority, which is what they'll need.
All right, Professor Gazarovsky.
Yeah, let me try to respond to your points. First of all, yes, Iran does have a very vibrant film industry, but most of those films that you're talking about are not shown in Iran. They're essentially allowed only for the export market. And there is quite a bit of censorship in Iran, and if you want further detail on that, go to the website of Reporters Without Borders and see what they have to say about Iran, and I think you'll be pretty surprised. The literacy figures that you mentioned, certainly those are accurate. I'm really not making a comparison between Iran and Afghanistan or Pakistan. Those are not really very useful comparisons because those are very backward countries. But the comparison is with the U.S. This is what I was trying to get at. And it's quite a bit lower. And the issue is not just literacy rates, but when we're talking about, you know, people having a broad understanding of things like the Holocaust, that's more kind of college education level rather than literacy rate would be the appropriate type of indicator. And Iranians certainly are quite a bit less cosmopolitan, less aware of general world history issues than Americans are, and that was the point that I was trying to make. The issue of class in Iran is important but very complicated. This is not strictly a class movement, and the Iranian Revolution was not strictly a class-based revolution. In Iran, class very much articulates with or correlates with cultural differences, sort of modern versus traditional, to put it in simplistic terms. Poor people, rural people, tend to, although, you know, not 100%, but tend to have more traditional values, being more religious, more conservative, more anti-Western, things of that sort. And as you pointed out, you know, the bedrock of support for the reformists are sort of what I would call modern middle-class Iranians who tend to be better educated, kind of more in contact with the West and these sorts of things. And they tend to live in certain parts of cities like North Tehran rather than South Tehran. And they're largely urban people, although not entirely. So you really can't talk about class in Iran without talking about culture also. And, of course, the same is true in the United States. If you live in a place like Louisiana, where I live, you see that poor people tend to be much more conservative, much more religious right. So class and culture really correlate or articulate in the United States as well. In Iran, the fighting is all about not economic redistribution. The fighting is all about culture, about whether Iran will remain sort of closed-off, insular Islamist society, or whether it will open up somewhat to the West and have more liberalization. And these are cultural issues, not class issues. Mm-hmm. So in my view, while the two of them are closely related, it's culture that is more important than class in Iran.
Thank you so much for being with us. Most informative.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Our guest this half hour, Professor Mark Gazarovsky. He is in the Political Science International Studies Program at Louisiana State University and is also taught at Tehran University, focusing a good portion of all things political on the elections that took place in Iran on Friday. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production in our studios here in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We're going to Springfield. I'll tell you more about our trip, which has been planned, and you need to sign up. It's filling up, so I'll tell you about that the first part of the next hour.